Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. Today is Tuesday, April 9th, 2019, and here is a very special edition of Nuclear Hot Seat. As those of you who follow this show know, I went back to Pennsylvania for the events surrounding the 40th anniversary of the nuclear disaster at Three Mile Island, not only because it was a meltdown with radiation release that contaminated the local area to an extent we still don't know, but because, as I say at the start of every Nuclear Hot Seat, I was there, staying with friends in their home in the Royalton area of Middletown within sight of those cooling towers when Three Mile Island happened. The experience of going back for this anniversary was complex, intense, emotional, and ultimately rewarding. I was there as a journalist and program host, but also as a survivor, somebody who went through the experience, lived to tell it, but still isn't quite sure of all that needs to be told. And that's what this report is about. The week was marked by a series of events with overlapping participants, produced by different entities, each with a slightly different flavor. First, on Saturday, March 23rd, the Historical Society of Dauphin County sponsored a panel of experts including Arne Gunderson, chief engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education, and journalist R.W. Swift, who was new to the Middletown area when he covered the accident in 1979. An upstairs room at the Historical Society housed a display of TMI artifacts, photos, articles, charts, and everything from technical information on the March 1979 meltdown and radiation releases to examples of post-TMI plant mutations from the collection of Mary Osborne to T-shirts and even comic books commemorating, if not lambasting, the disaster. While I was there, I spoke with one of the Historical Society event organizers who readily shared with me her experiences of March 1979.
I'm Marcia Gobrecht, and I lived in Harrisburg when TMI was taking place. And I heard it on the radio, and immediately I went to the elementary school for one child, then the middle school for another child, and the high school for another child, and we headed down to Carlisle to Dickinson College where my husband was teaching. And I know that wasn't far enough to go now, but that evening we went on to Hanover where his parents lived, and then we came back to Harrisburg, and I heard about the bubble forming, so I immediately packed up everything again, and we headed back to Hanover. And in the meantime, my sister-in-law, who lives in Erie, called and said, "You've got to get farther away. Come here." So we all evacuated to Erie in Pennsylvania and stayed there for a week. But I also remember coming home. They told us, don't buy milk locally because of the contamination. So we stopped at State College and bought our milk to bring home to Harrisburg. But it was a very frightening experience because you just didn't know, what shall I take? What shouldn't I take? Will I ever see my house again?
Marcia Gobrecht of the Historical Society of Dauphin County. Imagine, if you can, facing that level of fear and confusion with no way of knowing what the outcome would be. Another woman explained a reaction that I remembered getting from people in Los Angeles when I told them where I'd been.
Well, I remember vividly in Erie, whenever we went somewhere and they learned we were from Harrisburg, people would back away from us and say, "Are you radioactive?" They were even frightened to be near us.
They asked me if I was contagious, and did I glow in the dark? It helped to know that the responses I got were not unique. The TMI 40 exhibition room in the Historical Society was crowded with local citizens and activists from around the world. A small group of women from Fukushima were there, examining the artifacts, being greeted warmly by everyone. Hiroko Aihara, a journalist from Fukushima, was one of those women.
I'm based in Fukushima prefecture local journalist. I covered many news after nuclear accident in Japan, Fukushima. This time I visited here to cover and to meet many people, to ask the information about their experience after Three Mile Island. Because Fukushima accident has already passed 8 years, but you're very painful pioneer about the nuclear accident. I'd like to know a lot about your experiences, because in your 40 years, Fukushima is just 8 years. I'd like to understand in the future of Fukushima from your experience and your history. I'm focused on the very local people and very usual people, which included mothers, young generations. I just focus on that very local people, what they said, what they think, and how to survive, how to make a betterment to this situation. Beyond my profession, people-to-people conversation is very, very touchy for me. I like to talk honestly something, because most of the people encourage me, let's go together, you are not alone, sometimes warm hugs. It's a very important experience for me. They heal me.
Hiroko Ayahara, a journalist from Fukushima, saying of the people of Three Mile Island, they heal me. After this high-level anti-nuclear schmooze, we moved downstairs to the main room, where the panel discussion proved excellent, but the sound recording less so. Arne Gunderson presented key material on how much radiation was actually released from Three Mile Island, and fortunately, he shared that information under other circumstances that had better audio quality, and we'll have that part of his speech in a moment. That evening, there was a survivor's dinner at the American Legion Hall in Middletown. The room was abuzz with over 100 activists, community members, and the curious. But this was a night for the people. Stony Brook professor and PhD Heidi Huttner was busy in one corner, squirreled away across from the bar, shooting final footage for her forthcoming film and accompanying book, Accidents Can Happen, The Women of Three Mile Island. One of the women featured in her film, Joyce, took a moment to share with me a bit of her Three Mile Island story.
Joyce, where were you when the Three Mile Island nuclear accident began?
I was home baking cookies.
And where was home?
Home was in Lower Swatara Township, which is 3.2 air miles from the accident. And I know that because we got insurance money, you had to be within the 5-mile radius. But I did not know I was actually that close to the island.
How did it come down for you? I mean, how did you first find out about it? What was your response?
Well, first of all, I found out from radio. And then I talked to neighbors, and they were saying they think something really serious is going on down there. And then when the governor came on and advised women who were pregnant or had preschool children to leave the area, we left because we had a preschool child.
Mm-hmm. What kind of impact has this had on your life?
The past 40 years of being concerned about the health and well-being of my children, wondering if a shoe will drop, if they will have cancer, if it will be related to whatever happened on that island, and how will we know? You know, at the day of the accident, the stacks that they monitor where the radiation came out, the monitors went offline. So everything is a guesstimate. I've never been happy with that, and I just think that for the past 40 years, they've been stonewalling us on every issue and never really being honest with us.
Has there been any health impact that you believe is related to Three Mile Island within your family?
I have had cancer. My daughter has had cancer, and my granddaughter, who is now 19, has had cancer. So, I mean, those are things that make you wonder, isn't it? And the problem is, how do we know? There has never been any definitive long-term study. We begged to have the workers studied. We begged to have us studied over a long-term period because we know radiation takes a while for its effects to happen. But none of that has been done because they're either worried about what the results will be or the money.
You are going to be one of the women featured in Heidi Huttner's upcoming film, Accidents Can Happen. What did it mean to you to be asked to participate in this film?
I think what's so important is for people to understand that we are just average people, and something terrible like that happens to you, makes you realize that things outside of your control can grossly impact on your life and your family's life. You know, I can remember going to meetings and someone from the company said to me, you know, you should go home and bake cookies and let us take care of it. And I said to him, you know, I was home baking cookies when you all had your accident. That's why I'm here.
This cookie baking mom, and I say that with my tongue firmly in my cheek, had a very clear understanding of exactly why the nuclear reactor had been built there in the first place.
Well, one of the reasons why that plant originally moved here was we are a very conservative community. We weren't going to argue with them. The government knew what they were doing. The company knew what they were doing. We were very willing to accept that. And I was one of them. I bet you couldn't have found five people in the whole 5-mile radius that would have made a complaint. And look what that got us.
Joyce's full story and actions as part of the group she helped to form, Concerned Mothers and Women, will be featured in Accidents Can Happen. Heidi told me the principal photography is completed, and they're about to begin the editing process. We will have a link to her website for the film on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 407. Make sure you go there and take a look at the sizzle reel, because it does sizzle. And hopefully the film will be completed before TMI 41. Gene Stilpe is a longtime member of 3 Mile Island Alert, the anti-nuclear group that predates the 1979 accident. Gene gave me the short version of why more than 100 people gathered together that evening.
Yes, we're here at the 40th anniversary dinner of the ongoing accident at 3 Mile Island. We're here because we're gearing up for the new protest against the bailout of 3 Mile Island. The utility wants $500 million to bail out 3 Mile Island and other nuclear power plants across the state. So we're here to fight that. So everybody here has not stopped fighting in 40 years. We're going to keep on kicking ass.
Gene Stilpe, who had much more to say and much more to kick, as well as a key role to play later in the week. The crew from NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, drove in from their headquarters in Tacoma Park, Maryland, just outside of D.C., to participate in this commemoration of TMI's meltdown. It was great spending time with Diane DiRico, Radioactive Waste Project Manager for the group. When I last saw her, she was on screen in one of the films at the International Uranium Film Festival in Window Rock, Navajo Nation, in New Mexico. And NIRS Executive Director Tim Judson was there at the dinner, where he explained the importance of believing the victims.
The importance of, I think, what's happening here right now is that we're telling stories about what happened to people. And, you know, we're in a pretty amazing moment in the U.S. at this point where, because of the Black Lives Matter movement, because of the Me Too movement, we're elevating and recognizing the importance of believing victims and believing survivors and, you know, stories about what happened to them. And that is essentially what this anniversary is actually all about to me, is that the people that lived in this community experienced something incredibly tragic. And their stories have been disbelieved officially and covered up and been shoved under the rug for the last 40 years. It's time for us to reckon with the history of 3 Mile Island and of the nuclear industry in a different way. The experiences of people who live in reactor communities and live around nuclear waste sites have been discounted forever because these things happened in basically rural communities where the science of epidemiology, the science of statistics around public health, isn't equipped to document what happens to people in these communities. And so when people have cancer, when people are dying of strange diseases, people are seeing mutations of plants, you know, and animals in their environment around these sites, they're thrown away as though they're just anecdotal stories unconnected to anything specific that might have happened to them. And with 3 Mile Island, there's been such a deliberate cover-up of what happened here. You know, they say that there's no significant release of radiation, even though it was a meltdown of a nuclear reactor. What we've heard today are the stories and documented recounts of what actually happened at this accident. And it's clear that there was millions of curies of radiation released from this accident into a small community in a constricted river valley, and that people have been experiencing cancer and health effects and trauma for the last 40 years. And so it's time for us to believe the survivors of the nuclear industry as well as the survivors of domestic violence and racism and sexual assault. This is the same sort of corruption of the power structure that's happening with racism and sexism is what happens in the nuclear industry with the suppression of people's stories and experiences for the sake of a very, very powerful industry that is wedded to some of the most toxic industries in our society. And I think that by listening to the stories of what happened to the survivors and the victims of Three Mile Island, we actually have an opportunity to rethink on a broader sort of societal level what nuclear power and where our energy comes from means for America and for the rest of the world. And this is extremely important in the context of what's happening with climate change, because yeah, the nuclear industry is also playing a really insidious role in selling nuclear power as a solution to climate change. And now they're trying to convince people all across the country that in order to solve climate change, we need to bail out these dirty, old, dangerous, uneconomical nuclear power plants across the country. And they're talking about billions and billions of dollars that could be spent on renewable energy, energy efficiency, things that are actually going to improve the health and safety of our environment and solve the climate crisis, all to support a bunch of aging power plants that are increasingly dirty and dangerous, that is going to do nothing to solve the climate crisis. What we have to do is dispel the notion that nuclear power is clean energy. And that is really, I think, honoring and believing the stories of the survivors and the victims of Three Mile Island is a really, really important place to start in terms of unpacking the deception that sort of underlies the whole nuclear industry.
Tim Judson, Executive Director of NIRS. At the dinner, acknowledgments were freely handed out to long-term TMIA members, the organizers of the many events, and those who traveled great distances were singled out, though my trek from Los Angeles was well overshadowed by the Japanese contingent. One group that could not attend but send a solidarity statement were the Diné or Navajo people and their allies. It's not well known, but less than 3 months after Three Mile Island had its meltdown, a uranium mill disposal pond on the Diné Nation, 17 miles north of Gallup, New Mexico, breached its dam, pouring over 1,100 tons of solid radioactive mill waste and 94 million gallons of acidic radioactive tailing solutions into the Puerco River, releasing what is estimated to be more radioactivity than was released at Three Mile Island. Bill Kologi, who proved to be a skilled master of ceremonies as well as a longtime Three Mile Island Alert member, read the statement of solidarity that was sent from Navajo Nation.
A combination of personnel error, design deficiencies, and component failures caused the TMI-2 accident, which permanently changed both the nuclear industry and the NRC, and public fear and distrust increased. This was the same effect when 34 years earlier, the first atomic test explosion at Trinity, New Mexico occurred, and subsequently, the largest by volume single release of radioactive poisons in the history of the United States occurred in Church Rock, New Mexico. The Navajo Nation residents also awoke to the same perilous danger of the nuclear industry, just as the Three Mile Island survivors 40 years ago. We stand in love and solidarity to never forget the 1979 United States nuclear disaster, to hold accountable the United States government, to seek a united effort to provide testimony to the United States Congress on how there has been no just compensation, equal protection, and due process. We hope to create an alliance so our voices can be amplified. We invite you to come to our homelands. In beauty it shall be. And it's signed by three leaders of the Navajo Nation.
The solidarity statement was signed by Diné advocate Percy Anderson, Diné land defender and water protector Anna Rondon, and Diné journalist and activist Mervyn Tilden. The anniversary of the Church Rock uranium spill is July 16, 40 years, and ceremonies will be taking place in Navajo Nation for those who wish to attend. If I can raise the money, I'll be there. Among those acknowledged that evening was Christine Lehman, who along with Joe Rodriguez founded and admins the Facebook page Three Mile Island Survivors. The group focuses on health issues among those who experienced them. At the dinner, from the podium, Arne Gunderson acknowledged the group with high praise, and Christine in particular for her work in freeing up the health narrative from Three Mile Island. I spoke with her almost immediately after Arnie finished and asked what it meant to her to be so publicly acknowledged.
Listening to Arnie tonight, after watching him and knowing everything that he's done, I'm so full of pride right now for this group and what they do and what they're standing for. They're going to change history. And that's how I feel.
Christine Lehman of the 3 Mile Island Survivors Facebook group. The next day, Sunday, March 24, no official events were planned. I took the opportunity to drive down to stare the devil in the eye. It continues to amaze me how the cooling towers of 3 Mile Island dominate the landscape, even from miles away. They continually bloom high clouds of white steam, blink red lights day and night, and give the impression that they own the land and everything that's on it. The Historical Society of Dauphin County has asked for oral histories from anyone who had been at 3 Mile Island while it was happening. It only seemed fitting to me that I pull into the parking lot of Exelon Corporation, sit facing the cooling towers of the operating Reactor 1 and the long-dead, only 3 months old when it died, melted-down Reactor 2, and record my experiences. It took the better part of an hour, including plenty of time outs for emotional release. Then I drove through the Middletown neighborhood of Royalton, where I'd stayed 40 years before, and revisited the site of the home where I had been staying with friends, trying to remember, if not recapture, some essence of who I'd been before 3 Mile Island irrevocably changed me. Then to downtown Middletown, a handful of blocks and a few stoplights, to drop off a copy of my book, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, at Cuppy's Diner, which figures importantly into the narrative. But they were closed. I'd try again later. On Monday, March 25th, TMI Alert presented a press conference in the rotunda of the Pennsylvania State House in Harrisburg. Most of the local TV stations and newspapers sent reporters. TMI Alert Chair Eric Epstein, Tim Judson, and Arnie Gunderson spoke. Arnie again delivering information to respond to the question, how much radiation was released at 3 Mile Island? Here's an excerpt from his talk.
How much radiation was released? And the answer is nobody knows. And the reason for that is that every single radiation detector in every single vent that left the plant was picked. That when they built 3 Mile Island, they really wanted to detect the low levels of radiation that would be released. And they put all low-level radiation detectors in the stack and in all the ventilation systems. But when the disaster happened, all of those went off scale high. So nobody measured what went out of 3 Mile Island. So at best, scientists like me have to calculate based on what we know was measured out in the environment. The NRC on their website, very shortly after the nuclear disaster at TMI, came out with 10 million curies. Curies is a measure of radiation. And a curie is 37 billion disintegrations per second. So 37 billion times 10 million is what the NRC said. And I'll submit as part of this presentation that that's incredibly low. Most of the measurements were made by driving a car around through the local neighborhoods and out into the hillsides, and also from helicopters. And you'll look in my press packet, and I have two quotes from a senior guy at the NRC, a guy named John Collins. And John said that at best the car is iffy, and he didn't trust the helicopter data at all. Now, if you think about it, a helicopter takes pure air from above and pushes that pure air down on the radiation detector below, diluting whatever the radiation levels were. So the car data is suspect, and the helicopter data is useless. What I did was I plotted where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looked on the first 4 days, and I compared it to the peer-reviewed paper that Dr. Steve Wing wrote. 10 years ago, I met Steve Wing right here in the rotunda. Dr. Wing was an epidemiologist at UNC. 2 years ago, he passed. Wonderful scientist. And Steve showed that there was a dramatic increase in cancer along the Susquehanna River Valley. This is peer-reviewed stuff. This went through a rigorous scientific process. What happened in Susquehanna River Valley was that during the first couple days of the disaster, there was a temperature inversion over the valley, and that kept the radiation moving up and down the river, but it didn't allow the radiation to move up into the hillsides as much. So if you look at Steve's data, which is on these slides, but also in the material I gave you, and I'll have a PDF up on the Fairwinds website after I speak at Penn Central. But if you look at that data, you'll see a clear correlation to cancer increase versus where you lived in relation to the river valley. So then I plotted on the first day where the NRC looked, on the second day where the NRC looked, on the third day and fourth day. It shows, and it's detailed in my thing, that the data was not collected in the areas where the plume was moving. So that's one objective piece of data that shows that we really don't know how much radiation was released. Now, there was a guy at the NRC named Lake Barrett, and Lake and I were friends back in the 70s, and he calculated the 10 million that's on the NRC website now. But before he calculated 10 million, he calculated 36 million, and that's also in the Roggeveen report, which is the report that explains the disaster that that Congress authorized. The Roggeveen report says 10 million, but it also has data supporting 36 million curies, both by NRC. And which one did the NRC use, the 10 million? Now, a little bit of inside baseball. When I was an expert on for the plaintiffs, the TMI and brought an expert forward named John Daniel. And Daniel magically calculated 10 million curies was released. I looked at his expert report, and it was loaded with errors. And in fact, just doing the math correctly, but using Daniel's assumptions. So Daniel, again, remember, is an expert hired by TMI. I definitively showed that using Daniel's data, 150 million curies were released. Well, when Daniel heard that, he revised his report, and Judge Rambo let him get away with it. And he came in at 17 million curies released. So let's look at what's out there. The NRC is at 10 million. Daniel, the industry expert, after we caught him making mistakes in his report, came in at 17 million. The NRC Lake Barrett is at 36 million. And the actual industry data shows 150 million curies of radiation. Well, in the rotunda 10 years ago, I had never met Steve Wing before. And I believe that there's about 10 times what the NRC said was released. Around 100 million curies of radiation was released. Then I had the data to support that in the rotunda speech 10 years ago. But I couldn't understand why there were no cancers. Because again, remember, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is saying nobody died. There were no health effects. Well, Steve had the epidemiological data to show that there were cancers, and he couldn't understand why the releases were so low. So it was 10 years ago today in the rotunda when Steve and I met, and we realized that my dose data of around 100 million curies matched his cancer data up and down the Susquehanna River. Now, there's one other piece of information. Hershey was taking data, and it's well known that Hershey was freeze-drying the milk that they were collecting. Hershey continued to buy the milk from the local farmers, even though it was contaminated with iodine. What they did, iodine has an 8-day half-life, so if you let it sit for 90 days, the iodine decays away. So Hershey bought all the milk as if they were going to use it and freeze-dried it and waited 90 days and then added water back in and continued to make chocolate bars. But Hershey collected data that showed that radiation, iodine, was detected on farms 150 miles away. And that's in a book that was published a couple years ago by Helen Caldicott. So the net effect is that the organization that we count on to protect us, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, has the lowest estimate of radiation releases of all of the people that looked at it. The nuclear industry has higher values of radiation. Lake Barrett, an NRC staffer, has higher levels still, and I have higher levels still. No one will ever know, but no one has ever really tried to look at it because the NRC wants to minimize the impact of this disaster.
Arne Gundersen, Chief Engineer at Fairwinds Energy Education. The Rotunda in Harrisburg was an astonishingly busy place, with rotating groups of state champion cheerleaders, symphonic choirs, and lobbying college students jostling through the elegant high-ceilinged space. One young woman on a student field trip, Sonia Payne, took a moment to explain a bit about how the nuclear industry manipulated perception of Three Mile Island in the years after the meltdown.
When I was in elementary school, I was part of the Gifted program. We lived in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, and we took a field trip to Three Mile Island to learn about what happened, but also about what was going to happen with the nuclear program. For the most part, it was spun in a positive light. And what was interesting for me, though, was hearing my own parents' remembrances of when it happened. And they portrayed it very differently than what happened on the field trip. So for them, it was quite scary. They were living in Lancaster at the time. And, you know, they were afraid about it. It was something that no one was prepared for. And yet, as an elementary student who didn't really understand everything, you know, we were told that, oh, it was just an accident. You know, it won't happen again.
And there was no admission of the danger that was created by it or the radioactivity?
Not that I remember, only from my parents' perspective, that there was danger and radioactivity. Otherwise, no, I don't remember that as part of the field trip.
Of course not. Eric Epstein, Arne Gundersen, and Tim Judson did the lobbying rounds, bringing their opposition to a state taxpayer-funded bailout proposal for Three Mile Island to the attention of legislators. Only once they finished this essential action was I able to snag Eric for an explanation of what's happening with the bailout and how likely it is to pass.
Eric, what is the current situation between the state of Pennsylvania and the nuclear reactors here regarding potential bailout?
Pennsylvania is the one state where the bailout may not take. It's unusual because 20 years ago we deregulated the industry, and what we told the industry was that part of the deal, part of the grand bargain, was we gave them $9 billion. $5.4 billion went to PECO that owned Limerick, Peach Bottom, and TMI, $2.86 billion to PPL, which owned Susquehanna, and the rest went to Beaver Valley. It's been a success. You know, they're in a difficult place because Peach Bottom, Limerick, Susquehanna, Beaver Valley last year made a combined profit of $697 million. Pennsylvania is now also a gas state. So we have gone from a state where 92% of our electric came from coal and nuclear. That's now down to 73. The nuclear industry has been preaching diversity but practicing monopoly. So you have a lot of conservative Republicans who push for deregulation. TMI Alert supported that. We made a deal. Prices went down. We have abundant energy. And it's a tough sell. The only plant not making money is Three Mile Island, which has lost $300 million. In the last 5 years. And TMI is unique. It's a small plant, an old plant, and simply can't compete. Folks here understand that even if TMI shuts, we'll have the second most nuclear concentration of any state after Illinois. So Pennsylvania has always been described as Pittsburgh and Philadelphia with Alabama in the middle. Even though it's on the East Coast, it really has a rough and tumble feel to it. And, you know, a lot of folks here legitimately have a grievance with the bailout. They were coal workers. They were steel workers. We went through the Rust Belt experience. Right here in Harrisburg, Bethlehem Steel had 12,000 workers. We're down to 300. So we can transition at Three Mile Island. Unit 2 has been down for 40 years. Unit 1 has about 525 workers. So I think the issue that they're hanging their hat on is whether or not nuclear is an antidote for carbon. And we've proven that it really isn't. It's a false argument. You can take 3 Mile offline and it won't have an impact on carbon. So the other unique characteristic here is it's the nuclear industry for the first time. This didn't happen in New York. It didn't happen in Illinois. It didn't happen in Connecticut. It didn't happen in New Jersey. Is now being opposed by the gas industry. So the gas industry has a renaissance here. Pennsylvania now is a net exporter of electric. So we export 30% of our electric. It is actually the perfect time to shut down a nuclear power plant. We have resilience, we have reliability, we have independence, and the bill is stalled.
Explain further what you mean about having allowed the nuclear industry so many billions of dollars back then, and what the strategy was behind it.
Well, the strategy was this. The industry, you know, was a really large but predictable industry that had a return on investment, quarterly dividends, but the economics were such is that they were having problems competing. And they argued that they had stranded costs, which was interesting because the ratepayers paid to have all these plants built. So we said, look, here's the Faustian bargain. We're going to move to deregulation. We're going to let the marketplace be the referee. We understand that you have stranded costs. So we gave them 9 years. We called them CTCs, competitive transition costs. We're going to give you 9 years to recover this. We also told them you're going to freeze your rates because we didn't want to have rate shock. But after 9 years, you're on your own. You need to figure out how to be profitable. One of the sad stories, actually there were two sad stories with deregulation. The industry then sued a lot of the local communities to reduce the taxes they paid. So we saw a couple things happen. The amount of taxes paid to the local communities decreased and they downsized. So for instance, at 3 Mile Island in 1999, we had 804 workers. We're down to 520. So the industry has done everything they could to be competitive. They've cut workers, cut taxes. There's nowhere left to cut, so they're looking for a bailout. This is the third oldest state. One of our allies is ARP, which has 1.8 million members, and consumers from the seniors to like industrials, Procter & Gamble, and so on, are not supporting the bailout. So there is substantial resistance. The other big difference, Libby, is in Illinois and New York, there was existing legislation to increase the alternative energy portfolios. That's not here. So this is basically a bill that has to stand on its own merits. And right now, it's not standing tall.
What are you and the people of 3 Mile Island Alert doing to increase the likelihood that this bailout will not go through?
Well, what we're doing mostly is a education initiative. It's been 40 years. People forget, what happened during the accident. And as you know, from personal experience, it was a large-scale trauma. And so what we tried to do is explain to people risk-reward. You can have a nuclear power plant that operates well for a day, a week, a month, a decade, and like TMI, have a couple bad days and it's wiped out forever. And, you know, I think people now are coming to terms with the fact that TMI-2 is not cleaned up. It may never be cleaned up. The second issue is that nuclear power is an economic fiction. Without subsidies, it can't exist. And this is a state where the free market rules. Thirdly, we are probably in the most advanced grid in the world, PJM. So we have a very reliable and resilient grid. Arguments that may have worked in Illinois or New York just aren't working here. And it's a slog. I think Exelon miscalculated. They gave an artificial deadline saying they needed bailout legislation by June 1st. It's not the way it works in Pennsylvania. We're not real receptive to threats from companies based in Ohio and Illinois. We're a bit parochial, and nobody really sees a good reason to spend Pennsylvania taxpayer dollars to bail out-of-state shareholders. So it's been real interesting. This has been going on for about 2 years, and right now the rubber's hitting the road, and the industry's burning out.
How has today's lobbying gone? You've talked with a number of people while you were here with the press conference at the State House in Harrisburg.
The lobbying is interesting, and it's gone very well. Again, I view it more as an educational effort. And one of the things is letting people know and labor that we have a plan. TMI Alert put a plan to preserve jobs, create job training, make sure that taxes are paid to local communities. Other states have done it, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York. I think Illinois is the only one with a consumer cap. So we've tried to learn from the other states, make sure that there's a transition. But again, after transitioning from deregulation, a lot of these communities have already been hit with job losses and hit with loss of tax revenue. So it's not the same chasm that exists in other states. Secondly, there's a lot of conservative Republicans who are attached to the marketplace and are theologically opposed. Thirdly, you know, and this is raw politics, Donald Trump won this state not because of nuclear, but because of coal. And so you have some people who are saying if we're going to bail out anything, it would be coal. And the fourth issue is the environmental community, which seems to be split. Some are saying we should bail out nuclear as a way to fight carbon. Others see this as an impediment for getting renewables energy efficiency online. So, you know, we're having a dialogue, we're having a discussion. I've been working this for 35 years. This is by far the most lobbyists I've ever seen. Exelon has at least 36 lobbyists in law houses here. They spent $2 million last year. That's just in lobbying fees. That doesn't count campaign contributions. So it's getting rough, but the beauty of Pennsylvania is it's really a quintessential blue-collar state, and nobody here likes to be told what to do.
Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert. On Tuesday, the 26th, after posting that week's nuclear hot seat, I drove back to Three Mile Island with Dr. Norma Field, a retired professor from the University of Chicago who is originally from Japan, and Yuki Miyamoto, an associate professor at Chicago's DePaul University who is originally from Hiroshima. As they got their first glimpse of the cooling towers and we explored the commemorative markers and long-shuttered visitor center, a steady stream of cars stopped at the roadside. People got out, took photos with the reactor towers behind them, and then got out of Dodge. Two men got out of a car carrying impressive-looking film cameras. They took footage and stuck around just long enough to reveal that they were from France, working on professional assignment. I spoke with a local woman taking snapshots who presented a confusing narrative. On the one hand, she talked about her teenage terror at the meltdown, her mother's long illness, which she blamed on Three Mile Island, and their attempts to get compensation for her, which was ultimately rejected. But in the next breath, she protested that Reactor 1 needed to stay open because if it didn't, jobs would be lost. After she left, I wondered aloud about this seemingly contradictory narrative, and Norma, Dr. Field, who works extensively with Japanese people affected by the Fukushima disaster, offered this perspective.
I'm finding that people who have decided to stay on in Fukushima, even those who might be anti-nuclear, often make contradictory statements. For example, an evacuee told me that a farmer she had met in a gathering in central Japan was talking about how his rice had been contaminated and what that meant. And then at the same time, he was always bringing his rice to these meetings because he could sell them away from Fukushima. Or people always remember a young woman saying, I can't believe that people who worry about radiation eat white sugar. But I've learned how never to walk in the edges of streets because rain piles up in the gutters and those places are always hot spots. So we always walk in the middle of the street. You might get hit by a car, but at least you're avoiding radiation. So over and over and over, what seem to us as contradictions creep up in the speech of people who have to somehow reconcile themselves with living in a contaminated land.
Dr. Norma Field. On Wednesday, March 27, Penn State Harrisburg held a half-day conference. After a keynote speech by Arne Gunderson and a community panel entitled Art, Journalism, and Activism, another panel discussion on health, action, and public policy featured a fascinating presentation by Dr. Darren Ban of Penn State Hershey Medical Center, talking on altered molecular profiles in thyroid cancer in the TMI vicinity. It was highly technical, but well worth the brain bust to follow his research showing the likelihood of increased thyroid cancer being linked to the TMI meltdown. When Penn State makes the videos available, I will link to it on this site. During the break after his session, I ran into Cindy Folkers, who specializes in radiation impacts on health for Beyond Nuclear. Cindy offered a brief explanation of the health impacts hidden or distorted after Three Mile Island.
What brings you here to this event today?
Well, I was interested to see, particularly since this is an adjunct in Harrisburg of Penn State, what the take might be on nuclear energy, on the Three Mile Island accident. What they're basically saying today, what has happened 40 years since, and how they're perceiving, say, the Goldenberg thyroid study, what happened at the accident, if there's anything that we've actually learned that the nuclear industry has changed because of it. So I kind of want to take stock of where we are 40 years hence.
What kind of difficulties are there with figuring out what the impact has been on health of Three Mile Island?
Well, there were a lot of difficulties. And the first difficulty was that a lot of the monitors just simply weren't working. So they don't really know what exactly was released, how much radioactivity was released during the whole Three Mile Island disaster when it was spewing stuff out into the environment. We don't know what kind of radioactivity was released as far as the isotopes, the cesium, the strontium, the iodine. We suspect certainly that iodine was. But, you know, there was also an issue with the health impacts because there was a court order issued that basically established something called the Three Mile Island Health Fund. And as a stipulation of getting money from the fund, any researcher that wanted to use fund money was basically not able to look at the impact of higher doses. And if they had wanted to do so, then they had to have asked someone from the nuclear insurers to provide them with an expert to okay whatever it was they wished to study. It's an incredible agreement, and I say incredible in the most horrible way, because in essence what that did was when researchers used money from the fund and they did find increases of health impacts, they couldn't attribute those health impacts to radiation because the court said the doses were too low. But the court had no way to know exactly what the doses were. Come to find out, 15 years later, the only study that was able to attribute any of the health the disease increases to radiation exposure was the Stephen Wing study. He was a University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill epidemiologist, professor there. And one of the aspects of his study, in addition to the epidemiological process, was that he drew people's blood. And the people's blood who he drew complained of symptoms of higher radiation exposure, such as skin reddening, metallic taste in the mouth, hair falling out, those kinds of symptoms. He drew over 20 people's blood. This was about 15 years later when it was done. And he had someone look at the chromosome malformation, specifically something called a dicentric ring, which is known to be a marker of radiation exposure. When they did that, they discovered that indeed those people had been exposed to 600 to 900 milligrays, which is 60 to 90 rads, which is so much more. And again, this was 15 years later after exposure, than certainly that the court was willing to allow researchers to investigate at that higher exposure level, but higher than any official or industry person was willing to admit at the time or even today. So what the monitors failed to measure, the people's blood who were exposed during the accident, the disaster really, their blood measured it just fine. The thing that is really awful today is that this doesn't seem, that the fact that it was recorded in the blood, the radiation exposures were basically recorded in the blood, doesn't seem to have taken hold. These kinds of blood draws are not, that I know of, generally being used in most of post-accident scenario exposure dose reconstructions, like Fukushima, should be being used at Fukushima, should have been being used at Chernobyl for public, members of the public, not just workers, and not just military. And this test has been around, this dicentric chromosome ring test has been around since the mid-20th century, so the 1950s or 60s. So to me, it's completely unconscionable that you don't believe the biological data, but a court order you'll believe as saying that the doses were too low, having absolutely no basis for making that statement.
So it's 40 years later now. Is it possible that blood markers could still be found?
In the Three Mile Island, folks, I'm not enough of an expert to know. I do know that the technique is currently being used, although it's mostly in military or worker exposure context in the United States. It's out of Oak Ridge. And Fukushima, certainly. Chernobyl, possibly. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the blood draws at Three Mile Island, it was still showing, you were still able to get a dose read 15 years later. Now it's 40 years again here at Three Mile Island. So that would be a question for an expert. But, you know, we shouldn't be standing here saying, could we do it now? They should have just done it after the things exploded, after Chernobyl blew, after Fukushima blew. It should have been within the first few months that they did this. There shouldn't be a question. My question is, why don't they use this technique?
Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear. The sequence of events that led to the meltdown and radiation releases from TMI began just before 4 a.m. on March 28, 1979. That's why, every year since then, there has been a vigil at the gates called for 3:30 a.m. We planned to arrive at 3 a.m. and were surprised at the size of the crowd that was already there. We had to park a bit of a distance away and then walk in. And during that walk, that's where, beyond my will or control, I shifted from being a journalist, a producer, a program host, into someone who had been through a life-altering experience and had not yet given myself full rein to mourn. I was a participant at the vigil, not an outsider there to comment, and the emotional load hit me deep and hard. I began crying uncontrollably at intervals, shaking with a grief I had not experienced since that devastating series of events 4 decades ago. I felt no rage in me, just a deep and previously untapped sadness, something I had been alone with for all the intervening years. And then, I was not alone. I felt a compassionate hand on my shoulder and turned to see Christine Lehman. She had tears in her eyes, too, and without a word, we fell into each other's arms and sobbed for what had been lost, the lives we had never had a chance to live, a world that didn't want to hear it. Then Gene Stilpe took his place in front of the combined media of the world and explained why we were there, what the accident consisted of, why it has been protested so fiercely, why the bailout of Reactor 1 must not be allowed to happen. He introduced the women from Japan, gave them an opportunity to address the crowd, then asked for others to step forward and tell their stories. And they did. We stood silhouetted by fierce lights that protect the entrance to Three Mile Island and turned night to day, like an evening baseball game or Disneyland. Behind a painted line on the ground that we were not supposed to cross, police and TMI security watched, skeptical, or maybe just resentful of the early hour. At the exact time of the accident, we held to a minute of silence, connecting over the decades to the moment where everything changed. Then, with great intentionality, narrating his reasons every step of the way, Gene lifted his arms away from his body in a passive gesture and held them out as he slowly stepped backwards over the line into the forbidden territory of TMI's access driveway. Security seemed to be ignoring him, as he kept moving and nobody did anything. Finally, he turned as if to remind the cops to come get him, which they did. Reluctantly, because, let's face it, they were being filmed for the world to see. Gene was cuffed and taken away, and a little after 4, the vigil was over for another year. Driving away from the gates of TMI, I took a short side trip to Cuppy's, where I convinced the cook to open up and take a copy of my book after I told him that the diner and one of his waitresses figured in it. Then off to a much larger restaurant, where more than 20 of us from the vigil gathered for breakfast and commiseration. Gene Stilpe was there, having already posted bond. So were Christine and Joe Rodriguez, Paula Kinney, Norma, Yuki, the women from Japan, and so many others. I looked around at people with whom I'd shared such a profound week, and knew that while I might not ever again return to this part of the world, a part of me would always be with them, part of this community that survived Three Mile Island to speak of what happened and why we must never forget. To Hiroko Ayahara, who spoke of Three Mile Island as a 40-year vision of what's to come for the people of Japan whose lives were so devastated by Fukushima. Here's what I would like to say. In 32 years, at your 40th anniversary, you will be told by everyone and anyone that nobody died from Fukushima radiation, that your cancers and thyroid diseases and miscarriages and birth defects and heart attacks and autoimmune diseases had absolutely nothing to do with when the three reactors melted down and exploded, spewing radiation. You will receive no compensation for your illness, for your pain, and little sympathy. You will be mocked for your fears, ignored by the authorities, your calls for medical examinations and tests and collection of data left unheard, so that you will leave no trail of evidence that can be followed back to its source by future generations. You will be continually shouted down by louder, scripted, well-paid voices, told your truth is not your truth, what you know is not what you know, that black is white and down is up, and you are already through to the other side of the looking glass, Alice, so just shut up and go away. That's what it will be like. Here is what it will also be like. There will be a small band of heroes, women and men of great heart and mind, who reach out to each other to share the truth, to remember the truth, and pass it on, knowing that truth has the power to heal, and no matter how bad it was, better to know than to live with the crippling ignorance. That they will attract others to their cause, the fight to learn all that happened, what it did to people, and what must be done to prevent this evil from ever happening again. The voice of opposition to the nuclear insanity will never be silenced, and it will continue, and it will grow. Even in the most despairing of times, it will grow until it succeeds. And they will know that activist is a badge of honor for normal citizens who see a wrong that is not being addressed by the powers that be and choose to do something about it. Three Mile Island happened. Radiation was released. Damage was done to people and the environment. The government, the utility, the manufacturer, none of them took responsibility. Excuses were made, then heavily promoted, then mandated and enshrined as the truth, when what was being told was a bunch of overblown, distorted, encrusted cop-outs. But there were no monitors operating around Three Mile Island. No one needed to test the blood because it might show something alarming. They were just making certain that the dog ate their homework. The fight against nuclear has no half-life. It is forever, or as long as the isotopes of plutonium last, which, let's face it, in human terms, is forever. That is why I consider it my sacred duty to search for, seek out, promote the nuclear truth, and when I find it, share it widely, fully, with everyone in any way I can, for as long as I can. I invite you to do the same, and then pass the baton to the next generation, and teach them how to pass the baton to the generations after that, so that we continue. This may seem like the battle between David and Goliath, but I just wish to remind you, David won. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 9, 2019. My deepest gratitude to listeners who donated so generously, making it possible for me to take this journey and provide this report. Future donations for travel will be to get me to Church Rock on Navajo Nation for the July 16, 40th anniversary of the uranium spill there, so I may provide comparable coverage. And my heart goes out to all of you who spoke with me, on and off the record, to enrich the telling of the story. There is much more about this trip which I will share in the coming weeks and on the website, where we will have links up to material referred to by the interviewees under this episode, number 407. Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019. Libby Halevi at Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that the earth is a rock in the middle of a bubble, in the middle of nowhere. What happens on earth stays on earth. And no matter where we live on this beautiful blue-green planet, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.